Good morning, Fairhaven. Merry Christmas. My name's Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here, and super excited for today. I love this season. I love Christmas. I love the whole season. I love the day. If you know me, like, I'm the guy who puts his Christmas tree up before like Halloween, right? So like late October, that thing's up. I love this season. I love today. And part of the reason I love today is because I love the story that we get to dive into today. And so we're going to be diving into the Christmas story again out of Luke chapter 2. So if you want to follow along, we'll be in Luke 2. We will be putting all the words on the screen. But one of the things about the Christmas story is this story is such a familiar story in our culture. You didn't have to grow up in the church to even know the story. If you grew up and you were a fan of Charlie Brown, you heard this story, right? To grow up in our world, we hear Charlie Brown, we hear it through them. We see movies and TV shows and animations all telling this story, but it feels like it's one of those stories. It's one of those things that we can become so familiar with that we actually miss. That we think we so know the story that we fill in things in the story and sometimes actually miss the details of the story. And so before we dive into Luke chapter 2, I want to play a game. I'm going to call the game Christmas Trivia. Will you play Christmas Trivia with me this morning? You don't have a choice, right? Like, I'm going to make us do this anyways. But Christmas Trivia, what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask a question. There is then multiple choice answers. I'm going to ask for your response, for your answer. So, Christmas Trivia question number one. Jesus was first visited by shepherds. Contextually, shepherds were most often A, poor, B, young, C, female, D, all of the above. How many A people? B? C? How many D's? Correct answer is D. Well done, like the three of you that raised your hand. Well done. We'll get better as it goes along, maybe. So question number two. If you were here a few weeks ago, please tell me you listened enough to get this one right, please. So how many wise men came to see Jesus? A3, B6, C9, D12, E, it doesn't say. Anybody? Correct answer is E, it doesn't say. All right, let's go to the next question. All right, this is a good one. What animals does the Bible say were present at Jesus' birth? Is it A, cows, sheep, and goats? Is it B, cows, donkeys, and goats? Is it C, it's just sheep and goats? D, miscellaneous barnyard animals? Or E, it doesn't say? How many, do we have A's in the house? Any A's? B's? C's? D's? What's the answer? It doesn't say. All right, the next one. How did Mary and Joseph get from Nazareth to Bethlehem? Is it A, they took a donkey? B, they took a camel? C, they both walked? D, Joseph walked, but Mary rode the donkey? E, it doesn't say. We got some people disagreeing. The answer is it doesn't say. I would say of all of them, like if I was going to put my money on any of them, I would put my money on an answer here and I'd put my answer on C. We'll get there later. Next one. Oh, what does the innkeeper say to Mary and Joseph? Is it A, there's no room in the inn? Is it B, there's a stable you can use? Is it C, both A and B? Is it D, try the cave with a manger around the corner? Or is it E, there's no mention of an inn or an innkeeper? We got a couple different answers. The answer is there's no mention of an, and at this point, like some of you are going like, what of my childhood is real, right? Like, I get it. We will get there, I promise. Last question is not a multiple choice. Last question is true and false. True or false? Taylor Swift is dating the tight end with the most touchdowns in the NFL this year. Correct answer is false. Taylor Swift is not dating Sam Laporta. Let's go Lions, right? And this is the part you try to figure out, like, how do you recover from that besides just We're going to read from Luke chapter 2 this morning, right? So Luke chapter 2, we're going to dive into the story. But what we're going to do is we're going to try to dive into the story with some fresh eyes. I want to give us 6 layers, I'm going to call them, to help us understand the Christmas story. So we're going to start Luke 2, starting at verse 1. And a number of times we're going to stop and we're going to look at a layer of the story. So Luke 2, starting at verse 1. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Pause. The intro to the story, the thing we so often read over when we read the story, but the intro of the story gives us what I want to call the first layer in the story. The first layer is the layer of the census. Question, what is a census? Why are they doing a census? Why is the story even happening like this? And the answer, during the time of the first century, during the time Mary and Joseph are pregnant and heading to Bethlehem, they are living in a world that is under the control of Rome. Right? Rome is the largest empire the world has ever seen. Rome literally controls everything. So the question, how does Rome build what Rome does? How does Rome become such a giant empire? They not only can conquer the entire world, but they can also control and oversee the entire known world. The answer is to be able to be Rome actually costs you a whole lot of money, right? And so if you're an empire and you need a whole lot of money, how do you get it? It's the same way empires get it today, right? You tax your people. How do you know how much tax you expect from your people, from your regions? Well, it would make sense that if you want to know how much money you should expect to get out of a region, you should count the people in the region, right? So what Rome does is they start a census so that they can count who lives where, so they can figure out how much money can they expect to get out of taxes from the region. We actually know that during this time, Rome is going to take almost everything. Historically, we know Rome's going to take somewhere roughly between 70 and 90%. So can you imagine every year tax time rolls around and 80% of what you make goes straight in to Rome? We know Rome is taxing like crazy. They want to know how much to get, so they run a census. Census is layer number 1. We keep reading. So verse 3, and everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. So if layer 1 is census, layer 2 I'm going to call family. Because we see in the story, where do Joseph's family live? Bethlehem, right? And if you were with us over the last year, at Fairhaven here, we actually spent about 9 months working through the book of Genesis. So we dug into the story of Genesis, and there was a theme, kind of a topic, a phrase, actually, that came up often when we worked through Genesis. It was this idea of how family systems worked. There was this idea, this concept called the Beit Av. Beit means house, Av is father. So it was this idea of the father's house, that in this world, in the ancient Jewish world, you live with your extended family. That your family, you have the patriarch, the oldest living male, and the rest of the family is going to live around in that Beit Av. You live together. So the idea that you get married and you move off and you get your own house somewhere else, that didn't exist in the ancient Jewish world. You get married, you build a room on the Beit Av, you live together as a family. As history would continue, by the time the New Testament, this idea of the father's house would actually take on, they would put down walls. It would actually influence their architecture. They would live in houses that we call insulas. Kind of an artistic rendition looks like this. So your insula would have a courtyard, and then you would have rooms attached to this insula where different members of the family would live. When we go to Israel, things fully formed insulas don't exist anymore, but archaeologists have found kind of the remains of walls of what insulas would have looked like. So you together would have lived together. It's why when we look through Genesis, we talk about that call that God placed on Abraham to leave your land, your family, and your father's household. was such a significant call because you did not leave your family in this world. You lived together. Did you catch the problem in the Christmas story? What's happening? Let's put it back on the screen. So everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea to Bethlehem, the town of David. So what is Joseph's hometown? Bethlehem. Where's he living? Nazareth. Begs the question, why is Joseph not at home? In a world where you live with your family, why is it when Rome issues a census, everybody's going to be counted, why is Joseph not home? Why is he somewhere else? And I think this is a question that, especially if we don't know kind of the geography, we can also just burn right over. And so I want to show us where they are. So Bethlehem, hometown, is in the south. It's just kind of west of the Dead Sea. Nazareth is up in the Galilee region. We're a 70-mile difference. In their world, you walk roughly 20, 25 miles a day. So there's literally a three-day journey from Bethlehem to Nazareth, or in this story, from Nazareth back down to Bethlehem. Why is Joseph not with his family? Why is he at a little village in the north, 3 days away? Well, to answer that question, I want to jump into our third layer of the Christmas story, the layer I'm going to call work. Because we know something about Joseph. If you grew up hearing the stories, you might have heard an occupation, a job that Joseph had. What did you hear that Joseph did? He was a carpenter. Anybody hear that Joseph was a carpenter? Yeah, there's actually a story in the book of Matthew where Jesus is having conversation with a crowd. The crowd is trying to figure out who he is, and they actually say this. They say, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? Aren't his brothers James, Joseph, and Simon, and Judas? The problem is that word carpenter, that word we translate carpenter, really doesn't mean carpenter. In the Greek, that word is this. It's the word tekton. Go ahead and say tekton. Tekton. Tekton, most cleanly translates to the word builder. So we translate builder as carpenters because what do builders use to build in our world? Wood, right? You use wood. Builders build buildings out of wood. In the ancient world, if you're going to build a building, we just looked at a picture of an insula. What are you using? You're not using wood. There's no wood. You don't build out of wood. You might use a little bit in the construction. You'll put some wood in the roofs. But for the most part, you walk around ancient Israel, you're going to find everything was built out of stone. So Joseph, being a tekton, being a builder, most cleanly, Joseph is probably working as a stonemason. He's a builder. He's using stone. Okay, so how does that help us? So he's not in Bethlehem. He's up in Nazareth. We know what he does for work. He's a tekton, a builder, a stonemason. Well, it helps us when we recognize there's another city literally right across the valley from Nazareth. There's a city you've likely never heard of it. It's a city named Sepphoris. And during the time of Jesus' birth, kind of late first century BC, so 4 BC, Herod is actually having a Greco-Roman city built in Sepphoris. We know Herod's going to have kids. They'll rule over Israel. One of his kids' name is Herod Antipas. Antipas will actually make Sepphoris his first capital in Israel. But it's right across the valley from Nazareth. And if we were going to go to Sepphoris, even today, what we find is this. So this is the remains of a first century theater. What's it built out of? Who's going to build them? Tektons, builders, right? So you've got a theater. If you sit in the theater, you have this beautiful view of the Jezreel Valley. It's gorgeous. You go downtown Sepphoris, you're going to have all these Roman roads. Can you see the mosaics from where you are on the ground? All these mosaics on the roads. There's columns on either side of the road. There is a palace that has this mosaic floor. If we go to the next one, the picture of the woman on the bottom, they actually consider this the Mona Lisa of the Galilee, they call her. But this is in a room where literally there's this 30-foot by 30-foot floor of a palace that is just one giant mosaic telling a story. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So why is it that a guy from Bethlehem is in Nazareth, 70 miles away in the north? Well, it's probably because he's there for work. It's probably because Jesus' dad is actually helping build the city right across the valley. We believe Nazareth was likely a pop-up town of a bunch of people who were working to build Sepphoris, which brings us to our next layer in the Christmas story, layer number four. I think I lost track. Layer number four, poverty. Why would they move north for work? Well, we know something about Mary and Joseph. We've already talked about how much Rome is going to tax. Right? If 80% of what you make goes straight out the door, you're struggling already. But we know something about Mary and Joseph's financial situation, especially in what they offer later. So they'll have Jesus, and then we'll read about a sacrifice they make after having the son. We read it a little bit later in Luke. It says, when the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice in keeping what is said of the in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons. So what do Mary and Joseph bring? A pair of doves or two young pigeons, as is required in the law of the Lord, which should cause us to ask the question, where is this law? What is this law? What are they doing? And this is the part where we get to where everybody hopes, right? Like, you all came on Christmas Eve hoping we were going to read from Leviticus, right? It's never really Christmas until you read Leviticus. Where is the law that they're following? It's in Leviticus chapter 12, where we read this. It says, when the days of her purification for a son or daughter are over, she is to bring to the priest at the entrance to the tent of meeting a... what is she supposed to bring? A year-old lamb for a burnt offering and a young pigeon or a dove for a sin offering. He shall offer them before the Lord to make atonement for her, and then she will be ceremonially clean from her flow of blood. These are the regulations the woman who gives birth to a boy or a girl. But if she cannot afford a lamb, she is to bring two doves or two young pigeons, one for a burnt offering, the other for a sin offering. In this way, the priest will make atonement for her and she will be clean. What do Mary and Joseph bring? Do they bring the one-year-old lamb? No. What do they bring? The two doves or two pigeons, because they can't afford a lamb. Back to that trivia question. How did Mary and Joseph get from Nazareth to Bethlehem? In their world, a donkey would have been a sign of pretty significant wealth. If you can't afford a lamb at the birth of your son, you're almost surely, we don't know, but you're almost surely not riding a donkey. You're probably walking those 3 days pregnant on foot. Layer number four, poverty. But you see how they're putting together. Rome issues taxes. Those taxes make the people poor. Because they're poor, you have to go find work somewhere. Mary and Joseph find their way to Nazareth, and now they're coming back home. Which brings us to layer number five, the whole idea of the pregnant girlfriend, right? I think this is one of those stories that, quite honestly, we become so familiar with that we just read right over pieces of it. That Mary, in their world, girls are going to marry around the age of 12, 13, maybe 14. And at this point, you have this 12, 13, maybe 14-year-old pregnant making a journey back to Joseph's hometown. Now, can you feel the scandal in the story? Like, you don't even need to get back into the world of the first century to feel the scandal in this story. But in their world, this is unheard of. This does not happen. And now not only are they showing up to Joseph's hometown, he's showing up with a pregnant girlfriend he's engaged to marry, which brings us to layer number six. Let's read that one. He went there to register with Mary, who's pledged to be married to him and is expecting a child, which brings us to layer six, rejection. What happens when they get there? We read it here. It says, while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in the manger because there was no guest room available for them. How many of you read the story, you grew up hearing the story that there was no room available in the inn, right? Most of us, it's how Charlie Brown read it. That word inn is in Greek the word kataluma, and kataluma literally means guest room. See, in the ancient world, if you're going to build a room, you are going to build a room for your family on the insula, right, with your extended family in the Beit Av, and you would build a room for you to live in. So you have kind of one central room. You would often build a second room. Sometimes it's called the upper room. Sometimes it's called the guest room. The purpose of the guest room was it was to extend hospitality. If somebody needed a space, you had a space for them to stay. So you have your space. You have the guest room, the upper room, the kataluma. And then often you would build kind of a front room in your home. And that front room was for the animals. Think it's way easier to protect your animals when they're in your space. It's also really practical. The animals will actually provide heat for your house. And if you live in an area like Bethlehem, it's possible you don't build that front room. It's possible, probably likely, I would say, that you build your house on top of a cave. And the cave is where the animals stay. So Mary and Joseph, they show up to Bethlehem. And remember, why are they going to Bethlehem? Why Bethlehem? It's Joseph's family, right? This is not a group of strangers. This is not two people traveling to a place with a bunch of people they don't know. They're going back to family. When they show up, they're told the kataluma, the guest room, there's no room there. So the question, is there no room in the guest room? Because like Uncle Carl got here first and like he unpacked his bag. So like, you know, like we can't kick him out. In a hospitable culture like first century Israel, it doesn't make sense to me that the kataluma, the guest room, is not available because it's full and nobody's going to create space for a pregnant young couple. Unless, of course, they weren't given access to the space, right? Unless, of course, it wasn't full because somebody was in it and refused to get out. I wonder in the story if it wasn't made available because of what it would have meant to the family to extend it. Because in an honor and shame culture, if I'm going to bring you into my house, it says something about me. And so it feels in the story as though they show up. They're not given space. They're given the place or the end. So they're not put out. They're not put outside. But they aren't given the guest room. They're not given the kataluma. They're given the region where the animals stay. And that is where Jesus will be born. My question in the story is why? Of all the ways the Christmas story could work, of all the ways God's going to enter the world, of all the ways it could happen, why this? Why in the midst of poverty? Why in the midst of the scandal of an unmarried, pregnant, teenage fiancé? Why does God choose this way? And I wonder if one of the reasons God chooses this way is because this is literally the good news of the Christmas story, right? We call Jesus often Emmanuel, which means God with us. And in the story, what we see isn't a God who leaves the perfection of heaven to enter like this perfected version of humanity, right? Where he comes into this everything going. What we see in the story is a God who leaves the perfection of heaven to enter the everyday, normal, raw emotions and experiences that so many of us experience. That the good news of the Christmas story is a resounding declaration of God saying, I'm with you. I've been there. I know what it's like. That the good news of the Christmas story is it's, in a lot of ways, it is God entering our story. Because for some of us, we read the Christmas story and in a lot of ways, our stories resonate, right? For some of us, you know what that rejection feels like. Especially this season, you know, there's things happening, families getting together, and maybe it's families getting together and you weren't invited to the party. Or it's one of those rooms you walk into and like you're invited in, but you know when you step in that nobody really wants you there. There's some rift, something's going on. The Christmas story in a lot of ways is God saying, I get it, I've been there. For some of you, it's that idea of the reputation. It's Mary shows up and she doesn't show up alone. She's carrying this reputation that is going to follow her. For some of you, you know what it feels like to have people say things, believe things about you, say things about you. For some of us, it's that feeling of like, how are we going to get through the day? How are we going to get through the season? How are we going to make ends meet? How are we going to make it? The Christmas story is a God saying, I'm with you. I've been there. I get it. For some of us, we're entering a holiday season for the first time without somebody we love. Or the third, or the fifth, or the tenth. And every time we approach this time of the year, that loss just feels that much more potent. The Christmas story is a story of God who didn't stay there, but a God who came here, who says, I've been there. I know what it is to feel that loss. I know what it is to weep, to grieve. I weep when you weep. It's I've been there. I know it. I'm with you in the midst of all of it, not just in the good things, but in all of the things. See, I think sometimes we can become so focused on trying to make the story look pretty that we miss the beauty of the story, right? I've actually been thinking the last little bit about this difference between like pretty versus beauty. And I started thinking about it. And so I've got three kids. My kids are 14, 12, and 10. And this is the moment when they all look panicked because they're afraid I'm going to say something about them. But my girls especially started for Christmas. They're asking for like makeup. And I remember back, do you remember, have you ever seen like a kid the first time they get into mom's makeup, right? And you come out and like that lipstick is like a paintbrush, right? Like it's everywhere. But what do you have to say to the kid who walks out painted with all the makeup? Like, look how pretty you look, right? You're so pretty, right? This is literally what we do. And I can't help but think back to the first time my kids would do this. And sure, you do the thing. But part of me also is hoping that like they don't mistake the beauty that they have for simply being who they are for being pretty, right? That as they're trying to cover up, as they're trying to put, I want them to know the beauty that they have just in simply being who they are and who they are. And there's nothing they can add or subtract to change any of that. I wonder how often we try to make the story look pretty. And in doing so, we miss the beauty. That we put Mary on a donkey because it feels better to us to have a pregnant fiance on a donkey than walking the dirty, dusty, rocky roads, right? We put them in this really nice wooden stable because like it looks prettier, right? The manger that Jesus is always placed in, like you notice that like the hay is always like perfectly fluffed, right? Like it looks amazing. It's not, it's stone, right? But it feels like sometimes we try to make the story so pretty that I wonder if we sometimes miss the beauty of a story of God who has come down into all of it, to experience all of it, to not just take on the best of what it means to be human, but to actually take on what it really means to be human. And it makes me wonder how often we don't try to do the things that we do to the story to our lives, right? We try to make our lives look pretty, right? Like we'll all post things on Facebook or Facebook for the old people, right? I don't know what my kids are posting on nowadays, but you always take the perfect shot with the perfect filter because we try to make life look pretty. And in this season, one of the things I'm trying to do, a challenge that I'd like to give to us is to not miss the beauty for the pretty. Right, to not miss the beauty for just the pretty, that especially today, a lot of us are gonna roll off and we're gonna go to parties. And before the party, if you work like we do, like you do everything you can to make your space pretty, right? Like the stockings are all hung just perfect, the presents are under the tree. And if you are in a home where there are kids opening presents, you know what that looks like 3 minutes in, right? Like a tornado's come through. There's shrapnel of tissue paper and wrapping paper everywhere. Nothing looks pretty anymore, right? But there's the beauty of a kid ripping open a gift for the first time, right? There's the beauty of being able to gather with some of the people that are closest to us in family or friends or whoever might sit in those chairs around those tables in those rooms. That the challenge for me is to not miss the beauty of the season for simply the things that we try to make look sparkly or pretty. That this Christmas, that it's the message of a God who has truly come to us. That whatever life looks like, whatever space you find yourself in, the message of Christmas is a God who comes to you and says, I get it. I get it. I've been there. I know what it's like. And I've come for you too. It's my hope that that message of Christmas would take heart in each and every one of us this year. And would you pray with me? God, for the message of Christmas, for the good news of this season, of you, the God who has created everything that exists, coming into this world you've created to redeem it, to save it, to bring it back to yourself. And the way you entered the story by taking on flesh and bone, by entering into humanity as one of us, so that you might be able to bring every one of us back to yourself. God, we are grateful. And God, we just pray that as we celebrate another year of Christmas, of God with us, of you with us, that we would go through the season with our eyes open to the beauty that is in all of it. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.